Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Continuing our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. You know, even though science and technology were supposed to rule the day by this late date of the ongoing evolution of modernity, it does not seem to be the case. Everywhere you look, there are vampires and zombies and all sorts of creatures of the night, reminding us that we still wrestle with our supernatural hunches, our uncanny fears, our dreamlike specters, the ghosts of possibilities of other worlds, of other selves. And it's sort of interesting to track the rise and fall of various kinds of monsters, specters, ogres, dragons, basilisks. It goes on and on. And one can really make a legitimate case that by tracking the rise and fall of certain kinds of spectral entities, certain sorts of monsters and creatures of the dark side of the imagination, that you can learn a lot about what's also happening in the real world of history, technology, media, and the ongoing madness that is modern civilization. And it's almost like a sort of like the movie Cabin in the Woods, where there's all these different monster possibilities, and it's in the film it's kind of a dice roll about which ones get to make the scene. But in some ways our whole cultural consciousness selects certain ones as being incredibly important, the zombie being the obvious one of the moment. There's organizations of academics studying the zombie phenomenon as more and more mutations of the creatures exist and get developed in popular culture, in video games and films, TV shows, comic books, et cetera, et cetera. But one monster or creature of the night that I think gets short shrift is the mummy. And luckily, we're going to talk about the mummy today with Roger Luckhurst, who is a expert in science fiction, horror fantasy literature in the UK, where he teaches literature and writes about this stuff. And he's just come out with a wonderful book called The Mummy's Curse, The True History of a Dark Fantasy, which really looks at the rise of the idea of the mummy's curse in the UK, and all of the interesting ways in which the figure of the mummy as a sort of spectral figure of terror emerges from an earlier fascination with these things in British society in the early, late 18th, early 19th century, and really asking the question of how did the mummy become this kind of figure of horror, of cursing, of unexpected deaths. And we'll get into the specific stories that were told about the mummy. And it's, of course, this turn that sets up the sort of fantasy mummy that we see in the Boris Karloff movie from 1932, which I recently got to see on the big screen again, which was quite a treat and has some hypnotic elements that we'll be talking about with Roger, who's also very interested in the development of parapsychology ideas around telepathy and hypnotism and the occult at the same period of time that the mummy is going through this transformation from interesting object of colonial fascination to a figure of dread and disturbance. So I look forward to this conversation very much because, as I said, I think we're ready for a richer mummy comeback than those cornball films from a decade ago. So I want to see him strut his stuff on the imaginal stage. But before we bring Roger on, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dawu. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
So in your personal kind of pantheon of spooky creatures, where does the mummy sit? Is he kind of dusty in the back room? Does he got a lot of charisma still?
No way, dude. He's super important to me because I study Egypt a lot. And it was interesting how you started talking about modernity and these ancient monsters, because the etymology of the word monster actually comes from monere, which is related to memory. And the word monster literally means it's like a reminder or like an omen to like remember this. So I had done all this research on Frankenstein, which Frankenstein actually comes from mummies. He actually is related to the mummy too. I know we don't really think about that, but he was inspired to Mary Shelley, you know, by Osiris and the stories of, you know, the torn apart man who comes back together and is kind of sewn up. And that's the original mummy is, of course, Osiris, who, like, kind of in the tales from ancient Egypt, is reconstructed and then mummified and his body is preserved and all that kind of stuff. So the monster in modern times is meant to remind us of these other parts of us that have been lost. So mummies especially, they're this dead thing that can be alive. So it's like probably one of the most important symbolic monsters that there are, in my opinion. And it's funny, this is how you were talking too about like the British people's involvement in it too. I mean, I always laugh at the mummy's curse for the Brits, because I mean, they're first of all, they're invading a country, digging through someone else's tomb, and then there's like this whole horror thing like, oh my god, we got a curse. Yeah, that's called karma, man, from like digging someone else's business. Like, it's so retarded.
Well, this is a perfect setup, because it's what, you know, one of the themes in Roger's book is exactly how there's these hidden repressed memories embedded in the figure of the mummy, and a lot of them turn on this question of colonialist guilt. But rather than give away the rest of the plot, let's bring Roger onto the show. Roger, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. It's great to speak to you.
Yeah, it's really fun. So I know you love the fantasy genre, you love these figures, you love particularly the literature of fantasy and horror and science fiction, but you're also interested in historical context, in particular in the 19th century. So what was it about this particular figure that drew you enough to say, okay, I'm going to sit down and do the hard work and write a dense historical text about this figure, somewhat marginal, at least to conventional historians, of the mummy?
Sure. Yeah, it was my sense was that there were lots and lots of books about vampires and about Bram Stoker's Dracula from 1897. And yet there's a really interesting fact about Dracula, which is it was a very unsuccessful book, because a book came out that year by Richard Marsh called The Beetle, which was actually a mummy curse story. And it was far more successful than Stoker, who was largely overlooked. And I got very interested in short stories, hundreds and hundreds of short stories that were emerging in the late 19th century, which seemed to tell the same story over and over again, of this sense of an artifact brought from Egypt, usually to London or to a private collection of an aristocrat. And some of those stories are amazing romances. So it's about reviving a beautiful, gorgeous, or exotic Oriental woman. And you have this sort of fantasy of a relationship, of course, with a ghost. So there's no question of miscegenation here. No worry about that. Just a kind of beautiful romance. But the other half of the stories were actually these horrified, appalled, disgusted stories, which were full of fear and dread. And I got really interested when I realized that the first curse story published was as late as 1869. So this is incredibly late. And why that happened became the really kind of key element of what my research was about.
Because the figure of the mummy becomes sort of an object of fascination much earlier than that in the British imagination. So you're really looking at, why does this shift at this certain point? Can you give us a little sense of some of the earlier context of the kind of Egyptomania in
yeah.
British society, and this sort of a lighter idea about the mummy and Egyptian artifacts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the whole kind of craze for Egyptian taste happens very fast, and it happens because the British beat Napoleon in Egypt. So Napoleon invaded Egypt in 1798 with his insane dream of then marching on to India and becoming the emperor of the world. He got a bit stuck in the Egyptian desert, and he very rapidly left. And what happened was that he'd taken about 30 or 40 really famous scientists with him, and what they did was document everything that they saw. And this is the first time that the West really paid proper attention to Egyptian artifacts, to actually accurately writing down hieroglyphs. They still couldn't read them yet, but they were accurately documenting them and looking at these extraordinary, beautiful survivals from 3,000 or 4,000 years before. And as the deal for the British beating the French, they gave all the artifacts they collected to England, and they ended up in the British Museum. But there was no sense in which Egyptian architecture was considered tasteful or beautiful. That was the Greek model. So, in fact, a lot of the Egyptian artifacts in England were left in a shed outside the British Museum for about 30 years until they decided to build something to look at them. At which point, since then, and it's still the case, the Egyptian rooms in the British Museum are the biggest tourist attraction in London, and people became obsessed with them and obsessed with these kind of artifacts. And really, they weren't so interested in the bodies, in the mummies, too much. It was more just the sort of extraordinary architecture and shapes and beautiful survivals of these documents that they couldn't quite read until the 1820s. So there's this huge craze that happens right at the beginning of the 19th century. No sense of dread, no sense of anxiety.
Yeah,
well, and one of the documents in there was the Rosetta Stone, of course, which was what ended up allowing them to even, like, read hieroglyphs again. So it was like a resurgence, like the language was kind of even brought back to life. So it kind of pumped it all up, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that Rosetta Stone was one of the key artifacts that was traded between the French and the British. So it's in the British Museum, of course, but the great French translator of that, Champollion, actually solved it a couple of years before the English, much to their great chagrin at the time that the French had beaten them. But actually, it was a joint sort of European investigation. And as soon as they could read hieroglyphs, they could unlock the whole of that extraordinary theology that the late that the Egyptians had. And so, by the late Victorian period, they fully understood the theology of ancient Egypt, but also the sequence of pharaohs, and had already started telling these extraordinary stories of individual pharaohs, the great queen Hatshepsut, and so on. So there is a sort of massive growth of knowledge in the 19th century. The term actually Egyptologist was only first used in 1850s, so it's a very new science for the 19th century, but like all Victorians, they move really fast and devour all of this stuff.
Well, you know, I just went to New Haven again in Connecticut, and I hadn't been there for a long time. And one of the main things that I was seeking out were these marvelous this marvelous gateway, this enormous monumental gateway for the old cemetery there, the Grove Street Cemetery. And it was built in like 1845, so reasonably early in this process. And I think it's one of the first major pieces of Egyptian. It's totally Egyptian style. So what my question was on that is, how soon did Egypt become associated with the dead, with this idea, the spectral kind of dimension? Is that something that comes later along with this kind of increasing creepiness, or is it from the beginning
people
see them?
Yeah, it's there from the beginning, really, because what they the English, being imperialists at this time, all they see of Egypt is not the modern, very complicated overlay of Christian, Islamic, Turkish elements. They don't see any of that. All they see is a kind of empty land which is theirs to take if they want to. So there's a sense then in which they always regard Egypt as a place of the dead. That's what it's often described as. So they really focus on places like Memphis or Luxor, which are literally necropolises. They are just cities of the dead. And in the middle of the 19th century, if you went there as one of the very few tourists in, say, 1840, you could literally just pick up bodies wherever you went. And they use these bodies in extraordinary ways. They use them as fuel because they burnt for a long time because they're drenched in bitumen to be preserved. So great for nighttime fires. Also allegedly used on steam trains. So, you know, you just shove a few bits of mummy into the engine there and it burns for a long time. And there was no kind of sense really of dread. This is an empty, dead land and it's therefore available for modernity to seize.
Anything. Well, and even more incredibly, I don't know if you talk about this in the book at all, but mummies became a medicine all over Europe around that time as well. People would actually ingest some of these parts of these dead bodies, and it was considered a very strong medicine. There was a couple books that came out recently about the medicinal uses of mummies that really became hugely popular throughout Europe, which essentially was cannibalism, you know, but it had like, they had placed all of these, you know, I think there was even like some to treat brain issues, which is hilarious because it's so zombie. It's like ridiculous. Right. They would actually eat mummies to treat brain issues.
Actually, this goes back to the medieval period because mummy or mumia was a kind of spice that was very, very valuable. It was simply ground up dead bodies. But if you were a wealthy merchant or an aristocrat, you would carry a little purse of mummy, which was usually used either to, as you say, to basically be snorted, or else you would rub it on bruises to try and cure various illnesses. So that had been happening for centuries. The really amazing thing, I think, in the 19th century is that mummy, ground-up mummy, began to be used in a particular kind of paint. It was called mummy brown. And it was used in paint until the 1960s. Ground-up mummy was still in that kind of paint. But the famous Pre-Raphaelite painter Holman Hunt was disgusted to discover that he'd been basically daubing dead bodies onto his canvases. And he insisted on bringing the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood around to his house and holding a funeral for a tube of paint.
Wow.
That is incredible. So now this is one thing that I didn't quite understand until, you know, just finding out more about it, is that I always had the impression that, like, you know, only the real bigwigs got mummified. But it's from what this story opens up is that there were just tons of them everywhere in Egypt, just sort of like lying around or just, you know, in the open, you know, back in the warehouse. Oh, yeah, that's where all the mummies are and they're all falling apart. And so how widespread was it in ancient Egyptian society to mummify people?
Well, it was, it was classically very hierarchical. So really the mummies that we have that have survived really well, the ones that you can go and look at, however you feel about that, in Cairo Museum of the pharaohs themselves, incredibly well preserved because there were whole teams of the best specialists available for pharaohs to mummify those figures. And then below that, you would have the priesthood. So nearly always in mummy horror films like, the 1932 Mummy, it's always about evil priests. It's not really about the pharaohs themselves. You have this priesthood who preserve the knowledge and the secrets of the supernatural powers of the ancient Egyptians. So they're also very well preserved. Below that, though, there were many ways of preserving bodies. Less successfully and less well hidden inside, you know, wood and stone coffins and sarcophagi, therefore simply burying people in the sand, which of course in a hot, dry climate, no humidity, meant that these bodies were incredibly well preserved. So very, very much so that the poor could also do these rudimentary forms, but none of the immense ritual that you would have associated with a really powerful priest or a pharaoh.
Okay, so we have the situation where there's a lot of mummies, people are grinding them up, they're snorting them, no big deal. It's all part of this sort of happy, expansive imperial empire, fascination with the other that you're simultaneously conquering. Then something happens. A dread begins. How does that process happen? Does it begin with the actual artifacts that are coming in, or does it begin more in the imagination?
Yeah, now this is the crucial kind of hinge question, really, and it's I think there are lots of possible answers for that. I mean, and it depends where you are in the world, too. I mean, one of the earliest mummy curse stories happens actually in America in the 1860s, and there's a lot of theory about that. During the American Civil War, it was very difficult to get hold of rags to make paper. You didn't make paper out of wood in those days. You made it out of rags. And because cotton production had been disrupted during the American Civil War, what the paper mills started to do was import hundreds of tons of rags, so basically bandages from mummies from Egypt. And it was alleged that right at the end of the Civil War in Maine, a paper factory was the center of a sudden outbreak of cholera and that several people died. And within a few years, you start getting really anxious stories, no longer romances about how amazing it would be to revive a mummy and talk to an ancient person, but much more about what contagion do these forces bring. So that happens in America in the 1860s. In Britain, really the stories start in the 1880s, and that is so plainly, obviously, about the fact that in 1882, the British had only ever really had a political role in Egypt, and in 1882 they send an army, and basically they occupy Egypt for the first time, and they begin to put down a rebellion. They do so with typical Victorian brutality. In 1885, there is a terrible colonial trauma of a very famous imperial figure, Colonel Gordon, who is beheaded by evil, fanatical Egyptians. And that produces an enormous convulsion and a punishment, a desire to punish the Egyptians. So you might well have heard of Lord Kitchener, the famous Lord Kitchener. He's called Kitchener of Khartoum because in 1898 he got as far as Khartoum and basically he machine-gunned everyone in sight. So if you've got a kind of sense of a punitive role in this new colonized landscape, and yet you're taking objects out of it, you're taking artifacts away and putting them in museums and so on, there is clearly, I think, an undertow in English culture of a great anxiety about what's happening here. Not in official discourse, that's all about how fantastic it is to expand the empire, but unofficially, what popular culture does, what Gothic does, is really talk about the things that you can't talk about in the mainstream.
Well, in a way, that gives us a really good example of why it's so valuable to do this kind of work, do the kind of work that you do, and that it's some of the stuff that I've done as well, where you really look at the what's happening in the popular imagination, in pulp fictions, in sort of marginal culture, as a way almost like a Freudian, where you're kind of reading the symptoms of these guilt feelings, these fears, these dreads, these desires that you can't really acknowledge in the mainline centers of power and centers of discourse. And so it becomes a sort of imaginal way of doing real history. And I'm kind of curious about, as you spent so much time with this figure and you were tracking the imagination through the pulp fictions, through the actual stories of Egyptology, through the changing, colonialist conditions, the fluctuations of empire. Is there a point where you ultimately feel that these figures can be sort of or the appeal or uncanniness of these figures can be explained through the historical context, or is there something extra, something sort of additionally enigmatic or uncanny about these figures that elude you even as you trace them and begin to understand why they became important at certain points in history?
That's just a really great question. It's really, really crucial, I think, because, you know, the thing is, we wouldn't still be doing zombies or vampires or mummies if we could decode them, if we could explain them. So, you know, okay, the zombie is about multinational capitalism. End of story, next, let's move on. Because it doesn't stop the undead coming back. There still must be something else that's going on with them, which means that they're hanging around in culture and we get these endless various modulations of what's happening. Or indeed with the mummy, I mean, many people don't like mummy films because it's just the same story over and over again. But that's also telling you something. You know, just telling it once isn't enough. You have to keep, a culture has to keep telling that story. So it does suggest to me that there's kind of an enigma, kind of a supplement that is essentially involved in these very, very mobile monstrous figures that means that you can't exhaust them. And actually, you know, I can spend 10 years in bizarre archives in London digging out these stories that no one's told before, but it still doesn't exhaust the story, and people will still actually want to be enchanted by these stories. So, you know, we often talk about the disenchantment of the world, that we've reduced everything to rationality and to materialism. But the more that people say that, and that happened a lot in the late 19th century, lots of people saying we've now got it, we've explained the world. The more people do that, and we've got Dawkins, Richard Dawkins these days doing it over here very loudly and very publicly, the more they say that, the more you get these supplemental stories. It's as if we need that extra, that sort of supplement that is our place of enchantment.
Great. Well, this raises up so many fascinating issues. I look forward to talking more, but we got to take a break here on Expanding Mind. You're listening to, as I said, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dawu. We're talking with Roger Luckhurst about mummies, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dawu talking with Eric Davis and Roger Luckhurst about the mummy's curse and all that great stuff. So before the break, you were talking a little bit about how universal and persistent these kinds of stories are about the undead, and kind of tireless. And it's true, because you can look at even outside of Egypt, the stories of them, like whether it's kind of zombie style, or like some of the fun ones that I've researched are the ghouls, right? If you look at the idea of the ghoul, like even in India or, you know, all over China, they talk about the undead all through China. It's crazy. If you look, and even like some of the Filipino stories of like them kind of rising from the grave and stuff like that are so insane. And do you feel like, I mean, obviously it is that kind of enchanting aspect of any of those kind of supernatural things, but is what particularly do you think about the undead, even though it's like this terrifying thing? It's almost like it's so appealing to people in some way, even with the danger and the curse and that idea that it's something that is abominable and terrible. We really kind of like want it to happen, or like believe that that could exist. Like we love it. Like we just love it. And is that like some kind of thing with immortality for people, or even like as terrible as it would be to be a zombie? It's almost like we want to think that could happen just so we could come back in some kind of weird pet cemetery, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the you can take a really anthropological view of it and say that all cultures have a version of this, I think, because the undead figure is literally the figure on the margin, on the border, that helps define a definitive life and a definitive death. You can't have those categories working without this transgressive figure who's telling you where the margin is, actually. So I think there's a lot of work that's done there. You might say that in more traditional cultures, there is a much closer association with the undead and the dead. Still lots of, you know, fear and horror, but also an association with ancestors and so on that is much more of a conversation with these kind of figures. Whereas,
well,
I think
it's so severe, too. Like, look at Jesus is basically undead, right?
Sure.
If you look at
the
story of Jesus, he's an undead as well. So it's so pervasive. It's in our, like, most prominent religion as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And every religion, including ancient Egypt too, you talked about Osiris, they have this sense of rebirth. This is crucially what they're doing. But in a way, it means a passage through death back to life. So we are thinking in theological terms always about figures of the undead. I mean, and in Europe, of course, we were fascinated in the medieval period by preserved bodies of saints. You know, we didn't need to mummify them. They were miraculously preserved, and people would travel hundreds of miles to go and look at bodies that hadn't decayed and so on.
Yeah, so the incorruptibles, they're called, right? The incorruptibles.
That's right, the incorruptibles.
Yeah.
That's right. So that sort of sense of a fascination with the transgressive element, it defines really the boundary of life and death. I mean, my sense is that we're in really an extraordinary flowering of fascination with the undead at the moment. And my sense is that a figure like the zombie is really, because it's so focused on brain death, is really crucial in the sense that we have in the West, in advanced industrial countries, we've basically reinvented death. We've pushed it. We've disarticulated it. It's become multiple elements so that it used to be the case until quite recently, if your heart stopped beating, your brain would shut down. That's a definitive kind of death. Whereas now, of course, you can have brain death but keep the body going, artificial ventilation, coma states, persistent vegetative states. It's all focused really on how dead does the brain have to be before you declare death. And this was redefined radically in America in 1968, actually, the same year as Night of the Living Dead. That sort of sense of us redefining, that technology has changed the concept of death for us, I think means that we have this huge kind of resurgence of interest in vampires and zombies. Less so in the Mummy. That seems to be very, for me anyway, it seems to kind of have the air of the 1920s of Tutankhamun and all that sort of stuff, partly because I think it's such an individual figure. You know, it's the royal undead figure, the singular aristocratic kind of figure, whereas we're much more interested now in the masses of undead, in the zombies that constantly swarm about us. So I think it's a lot of questions around there about how this undead figure does lots and lots of cultural work for us.
Now, here's a question that I always wonder. I ask myself this all the time, and it's hard because it's hard to answer it when you're fascinated with these particular topics. But sometimes it seems like there's a general uncanniness around the dead, our own future death, the persistence of the dead, the memory of the dead, the objects associated with the dead, the corpse itself. There's all of this spookiness and uncanniness which feeds into magic, it feeds into our nightmares, it feeds into dream, it feeds into our religion. And we can look at popular culture as this place where, you know, modern, supposedly rational, supposedly scientific, no longer supernatural people were able to kind of, you know, to sort of tuck away the uncanny, you know, so it's still part of our world, but it's inside of a pulp fiction. It's a B movie the teenagers go to. You know, we keep it at bay inside of the cultural space so that we can keep everything else clear, supposedly, for reason and science and technology. And but yet you can always see the way in which these things are leaking out, et cetera, et cetera. And what I can't tell is sometimes I look at our contemporary world and it seems like even it's done an even better job of banishing the uncanny and the magical from the actual objects of our world. And yet the next day I look at it and everywhere I see traces, leakages, the impossibility of avoiding the uncanny or the spectral, even in the midst of our ordinary lives. And I know you track, you've been tracking exactly this kind of line through your research through the 19th century, but also in today. How is that changing? How, is it moving? Is it a moving, constantly moving target? Is it well partitioned? How is it shifting now?
Yeah, that's another really great question. I think it is constantly moving, and therefore constantly we need, you know, figures like the undead to shift and change in order to manage our anxieties about where that boundary is. In the late 19th century, really there was a sense in which they were going through a major industrial revolution, the electronic revolution, the kind of stuff that you've written about, Eric. And it was full of uncanny supplements. So there were lots and lots of, you know, it wasn't just that we can now telephone across the continent, but that the dead are on the line as well. We can hear them crack in the crackles of the telephone, or we can hear them down the line of the telegraph, or we can capture them in this newfangled photography, and so on. And my sense is really that we're living right now through the third industrial revolution, the digital one, and I think there's lots of digital uncanny around at the moment. So a sense in which the internet is haunted or is the place for where unofficial knowledges lurk, conspiracy theories or strange spectral ghost sites and so on. So I think it every time we try and capture things in a purely materialistic way, as sometimes science and technology tends to do or have these very loud advocates that say we've solved everything. Once that happens, you get this excess, this supplement, this uncanny, which comes back and haunts us. I feel a bit the same as you, that sometimes you're reading about a secular society, that we're increasingly secularized, that we've battered away all of this kind of sense of death and uncanny and fear, and yet the news is full of these stories, and our popular culture is too. You know, this obsession with uncanny technologies, with what that might open out, with these new kind of forms of spiritualism emerging. So, I do think it's a constantly moving target.
Well, I don't want to lose. This is, you know, fascinating set of questions you've opened up, but I don't want to lose track of the mummies, like, you know, looking at me, you know, pulling at me over my shoulder, going, "Hey, we're not done with me yet." But because I wanted to ask a couple more questions about the connections you make in the book, because they seem particularly fruitful to me. One is the connection between not so much the mummy in general, but the Egyptian imagination and the occult revival in the late 19th century, which in England, especially with the Order of the Golden Dawn, was an incredibly influential order. And we're interested in the occult on the show, and we've talked about this stuff. So that's a very interesting link. But particularly, how that ties into this question of hypnotism and this sort of modern parapsychological sort of half occult, half a psychological category of altered states, of power, of control. So much is embedded in that. I almost felt like you could have done a whole other book on hypnotism and that whole kind of relate questions of control and things that seems still very relevant to us today. So I know I throw a lot of stuff at you there, but I'd love to hear your riff on it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, this is an area that I got really interested in, because there's a particular object in the British Museum which is known as the Unlucky Mummy. and it's the cover of a coffin cover, so just a lid, a wooden lid, with the face of an absolutely beautiful, I think, beautiful priestess on the front of it. But it became known as the Unlucky Mummy because it was said that whenever you looked at it, her stare back at you, her eyes are perfectly kind of, you know, cold. You can you can really kind of capture her gaze, if you like. It was said to be so malignant, so nasty, that it would do extraordinary negative, deathly things to anyone who gazed upon it. And there's still a sort of sense of anxiety around evil eyes on mummy cases to the present day. And that seemed to me to tie up quite a lot with this idea of the evil hypnotist or the evil mesmerist, who simply through the power of his gaze, he would latch his gaze onto, usually was a him, and really fix you in his power and stare you down until he was your will was completely under his control. And actually in the 1890s in England, hypnotism was a brand new science. No one understood what trance states were. They knew that they did actually medically exist. They could prove that, but they had no idea of what sort of state of consciousness people had got into. Still a very enigmatic and puzzling area. But these hypnotists, they were nearly always foreign hypnotists as well, from Germany and France, of course, who were threatening our fine, upstanding women with their menacing sexual threat. And that, again, begins to get tied up with occult movements like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. You can hear Egypt twice in that name, in Hermes and in the Golden Dawn, you know, the sun god Ra. So they are picking up on what they said was Egyptian magic. And they always talked about sending punitive currents out at people who transgressed the rules of this occult order. And Aleister Crowley was constantly described, you know, the great antichrist of the late Victorian and Edwardian period, this evil demonic figure.
We seem to have lost Roger.
Oh, boo.
Maybe they'll give. Hopefully, our folks will give him a call and get him right back.
Dude, you totally cut out right when you said Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, I know. Maybe. So hopefully we'll get him back on the line here. And in the meantime,
the curse of Aleister Crowley.
Well, no, it's totally you know, appropriate. You know, the sense that he, one of the things that Roger talks about in the book is the what he calls the recursive curse, which was the idea that the not only could you be cursed by the mummy if you were an excavator or the rich aristocrat who was funding the excavator, but if you were a journalist writing about the mummy's curse, that could take you down too. So there's this idea that if you just talk about it like we're doing right now, you're opening yourself up for the same malefic influence as if you were actually in the house. And maybe Crowley there had something to say about it. But it's really interesting too, like, you know, how do you see the turn towards Egypt in like the Golden Dawn? Like what it's sort
well,
of
yeah,
like,
yeah, so I mean, you know what happened was Gregor Mathers and his wife Moina, they would reenact it, like they would do these plays, you know. I don't know if you would even call them plays, they were more rituals, but it was so creepy because they would put it on like a play, like for all these people, you know, British peeps to come and see, like it was entertainment. But really what they were doing was reenacting the rites of Isis and Osiris, you know. And so they were like you said, they were kind of like bringing up invocation of the name of this thing. So it started that energy kind of aggregating there by literally like pretending in a very shamanistic, contagious magic sort of way to make it go. And I mean, Crowley went to Egypt and channeled the Book of the Law, or actually his pregnant wife at the time channeled it, at the pyramids. So, you know, I mean, that he was right there doing it at the spot. You know, talk about bringing in the energy of it. Jeez.
Yeah, and Egypt is also, or at least the, I think it's actually in Algiers, but just the sort of imagination of North Africa, where he, you know, did some of his most notoriously demonic rites. And it's kind of interesting when you think about the occult imagination, how much it is kind of located in these very, you know, colonialist situations. You know, the whole idea of, you know, of how much is the figure of Kali that we see in the yoga, you know, halls today, sort of weirdly related, reverberating through time from this experience of, you know, the British Empire, you know, encountering thuggies, you know, this terrifying sect that seemed to be happy to decapitate people and
yeah.
take their stuff, but also doing it for religious reasons. I mean, what a terrifying, you know, idea to a proper upstanding British, you know, bureaucrat in the far reaches of the empire. And then suddenly, like, reversal. Reversal. Now you have, you know, the great, you know, the grandchildren or great grandchildren of these people worshiping Kali in the yoga halls.
It's hilarious. It's so hilarious because it's true. It's like the very race of people that condemned it to hell as being evil then like start practicing it in this like fun way, you know, like that basically wiped out all the pagans and were the reason why we didn't even know what the hieroglyphs meant. Then it comes back around again. They go take it back from the French people and then it becomes like the subject of their movies and like parlor tricks, you know?
It is very roundabout. And I think if I remember correct, of course, the zombie too, at least the etymology of the zombie is of course totally linked to Haiti and the whole bizarre political force that Haiti has in the imagination because, you know, even if you just say like, oh, Haitian voodoo, you think of voodoo, it's so intense, it's a supernatural place, but it's kind of screwed up because it's a poor country and it's da-da-da, it's not even part of Africa, what's going on? But part of the reason that we have that sense of uncanny unease around the imagination of Haiti, I'm not talking about the actual place necessarily, but part of that imagination has to do with the fact that it was this rebellious country where the slaves, you know, kicked out and killed their European masters, and that's an extremely upsetting thing for the you know, Euro-American white pride consciousness. And so some of that dread and some of that unease feeds into these monsters that then go on to change and become very different than in their traditional zone. But once again, if you look at a monster, you're going to find some interesting political violence seems to be part of the message here.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, monsters' involvement in politics is all over China, you know, in the East. I mean, people, like you said, we don't talk about it so much over here because we don't connect it to the politics. I mean, but for sure in Haiti and all the slave trade, it was there. But if you look at stories all over China, it would affect the empires. Like it was so ingrained in, you know, how the emperors would run, those kind of like superstitions and belief in the undead and like the way that you treat ancestors to prevent them from becoming zombies was very accepted and very pervasive, that if you didn't do proper things, you would get an angry ghost or a zombie if you didn't treat, you know, your ancestors in a certain acceptable way or treated someone bad, you would make a hungry ghost that would then come try and eat you, you know?
So do you see things like that happening now? You know, it's always this weird question whenever we talk about this relationship between death and the supernatural. You know, they're so tightly coupled historically. In any culture you look at, you're going to find this really rich link that makes sense. And then we look at us, where we have such a weird relationship to death, and this weird, like, the uncanny is here, but it's not here. It's in popular culture, the stories we tell, but not in our real lives. And yet we're still facing the same problem of memory of the death of loved ones, the death of people we are scared of, the what to do with the corpse. You know, we're not out of this anthropological situation, but how does it manifest? I mean, how do you see that shifting now, that coupling of death and the supernatural?
Well, it's interesting that it is rising, like with the vampires and the zombies in popular culture. And what is happening on the opposite spectrum of that, which I think speaks to your question, is where we don't participate in death as much. Like, people don't even go to open casket funerals anymore. It's become, like, out of vogue. So, like, death is taken further and further away from us. We stick old people in the hospices. We don't participate in their decline. Everyone just kind of hears about grandma dying, but she's been in the home for so many years that we don't even know who she is anymore. So because we've removed those elements from our consciousness, I think that's why, like, there's this opposite, like, you know, kind of kickback almost with the vampires, because it's like, hey, remember me, good old death? Like, this is what it is. You guys need to look at it, check it out, like, quit ignoring it. It's almost like it's a way to counterbalance our attempt to ignore death. Death has, as a spirit, reinfused all this stuff in our culture, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that I mean, it seems like it's just maybe beginning to change a little bit. I was talking to a friend who lives in a, you know, pretty groovy rural community in Wisconsin. You know, they have organic farmers and people who are leaving the city and you know, and then old school folks and Amish people or whatever. But it's, you know, not a huge community. And some teenager had died, I think, in a car accident, but it wasn't, you know, horribly disfiguring. Or it actually may have been a disease. I don't remember what it was, but they weren't disfigured in their death. And they put the body on the outside porch of the home.
Wow.
So it was kind of like open, you know, it was just open. People would sit there and sit with the body, and kids would come by. I mean, particularly for young people who knew this kid in high school. And, you know, it's so shocking particularly when you're young, to have that kind of thing happen. And, you know, it's really interesting because you're like, well, in a way that's, I mean, obviously that's so much more human and integrated and, you know, and holistic, but you still have to, like, in a way you have to accept the uncanniness more directly. It's not like it just becomes normal. I mean, it's still weird. It's still, you know, even if it's part of your life and it's like, you know, it's normal in the sense that you accept that people die, people age, but there's still a kind of uncanniness there that you have to kind of make room for it. Whereas what we do is we almost put our emotions into the movies. You know, like, it's okay to go and see the movie and then feel the emotion there, but don't let that emotion come into my actual life. I can't. That's not fair. That's not the contract. You know,
right? And I mean, it's true, because our attempts to separate our actual involvement with realities, whether it's you know, labor, like we do that with sending all of our crappy jobs to other people to do. We send all the things we really don't want to deal with into other places and other compartments. So, I mean, death is obviously a giant one of those that we've just, like, sent into another compartment. But in order to, like, still accommodate its existence, we'll have it in this, you know, voyeuristic, satisfactory, but non-participatory avenue.
Yeah. You know, I've even thought about the whole thing about cremation. Now, you know, the sort of, like, the groovy thing to do is to, you know, get cremated. You know, that's a lot of liberal people, like Marin County, which is one of the most liberal counties in California. It has this incredible cremation rate, like 80%. I mean, something insane. And you know, I feel that way too. You know, a lot of people I know, oh yeah, I'm going to be cremated. But sometimes I think that part of the appeal of cremation is because you don't have to deal conceptually with the idea of a corpse. Like, if you're going to be burying, and you know, we hide that in other ways, the fancy coffin, the closed coffin, you're not actually looking at the body, you know. But there's something even more like, well, they're cremated, they're gone. Well, what's gone? What's gone is the corpse. And
yeah,
it's the corpse,
exactly.
Really, that is the uncanny thing, because it's a thing. It's not just a memory. It's not just something grandma had. It's like grandma, but not grandma. And it's in my house, and it's starting to smell, and we have to do something about this situation. It's very, very confusing and freaked out. And that's the part where we don't know how to do. I've hardly seen any corpses in my life, in human corpses. Even animal corpses, I haven't seen that many other than roadkill.
Well, which is another thing, right, is that we're a culture that consumes the majority of meat in the world, but how many people deal with the animal carcass? We don't deal with the death that we cause to the animals that we consume. So we don't deal with that corpse, with the carcass, with the aftermath, unless it's, we like to just keep all of that tucked into a compartment too, which I think is kind of like the same thing. We don't deal with the corpses, whereas, in other places like India or China, dead people are just caught. They're like out on the porch,
Do you have a sense of like what people now in the West who are concerned about this are kind of doing about it? I mean, what other have you heard about? I mean, I heard a little bit about green burials and this and that, and then I heard the story from Wisconsin. It was really inspiring, but I'm not really sure. It's like it almost seems like part of the kind of maker culture, get back to canning your tomatoes and making sauerkraut and all this stuff, that like part of that reclamation of physical experience would be changing the way that we deal with death and dying, but I don't quite see it happening. So I'm just kind of curious whether you're aware of people sort of taking this on.
Well, I was doing a death lecture series a little while back, about 2 years ago, and through that I got to meet the Los Angeles County Coroner, who obviously deals with all. If you can imagine being the Los Angeles County Coroner, the amount of things that you would see. So I had a couple really interesting conversations with him about how are people dealing with death, and at least in Los Angeles, it doesn't look like there's any kind of movements towards like reconciling that. He would just say literally no one would want any involvement. He would always like have to be basically responsible for everything, and no one even wanted to talk about it. People treat him, like he's a freak a lot of times if they find out what he's doing. Not everybody. He obviously has a lot of friends and people that have a good – and he had a great humor about it. He was, like, one of my favorite people to talk to about death. But if he is any gauge on, like, how at least in Los Angeles it's happening, it's not going down.
Yeah, well, we're going to have to continue on this topic on later programs. We're going to have to wrap it up right here. We never got Roger back. The curse of the mummy struck again. Clearly, it was good talking to him for a while. We rallied, and so from me and Maja to all you out there, keep your minds open.